Are your wages keeping pace with the cost of living? When you hear about executive salaries, it can make your own position feel even tighter. Actually, it can make you feel like weeping uncontrollably. There's been a lot of debate about executive salaries, especially since the global financial crisis, and the concern about the gap between top income earners and the rest. Labour MP Andrew Leigh, formerly an economist at the ANU, has updated his statistics of top income groups and their share of our national income. And he joins me now. Welcome back, Andrew.
Thank you, Richard. Good to be back for, I think, our final chat.
It will be our final chat. Now, what are the latest figures, which I think go back to 2009, telling you?
Yes, Richard. So the numbers run all the way from 1921, when we can first crunch them, back to 2008, 2009. And what you see is a big U-shape. The income share of the top 1% in Australia steadily fell all the way from about the 1920s through to 1980 or so. And then in 1980, you see this turn and inequality starts to rise. The income share of the top 1% roughly doubles over that period. And when we add in the most recent year, which is 2008-09, you see a small dip down.
Yes.
During the global financial crisis. But my guess is that that's a blip rather than a turnaround in the trend.
Right. And as you mentioned, on the longer time scale, we've seen this very rapid rise in the share of top income earners since the 1980s. They've been getting richer faster.
That's right. So the top 1% have basically doubled their share of national income over that generation or so. If you go further up the distribution, you look at the top 0.1%, the richest 1/1000th of Australians, they've tripled their income share over that period. So the action is actually further up the distribution. The more you go towards the super, super rich, super duper rich, the more you see an increase in the income share. That's true of Australia, but also it's true of a range of Anglo-Saxon countries. The super rich have accelerated away from the middle.
Well, I wanted to ask about that, because if I'm reading the graph correctly, the top 1% earned about 8.5% of total income in 2009, and the top 0.1% earned about 3% of all income. Is that right?
Exactly. So one way of thinking of that is the top 0.1% are getting about 29 times their proportionate share of national income.
Yeah. How do we compare to countries like the UK and America and Canada and New Zealand, other Anglo countries, if you like?
Well, the shape of the picture is very similar across the Anglo-Saxon countries. This U-shape, the fall in inequality in the post, particularly in the post-war period. I think most people in the modern era think that inequality is something that only ever goes up. But actually, that's not true. For a lot of this period, inequality fell in the Anglo countries and then rose in the last 30 years. But the level is a little lower in Australia than it is in Britain and particularly the United States. So while inequality has risen in Australia and the US over the same period, our level of inequality is about where theirs was in the mid-1980s.
So, and this increase in wealth in the top income groups, it's not confined to the Anglo-Saxon countries. I think we've seen it in China as well, haven't we?
Yes, that's right. You certainly see a more modest increase in China. You don't see quite as marked change in the non-English speaking countries. And part of that, I think, has to do with the fact that one of the things driving top income shares is travel, is the fact that that the best lawyers, accountants, business people are now playing in an international market and they're earning an international wage. But of course, that only works if you speak English. If you only speak French or German, then you're still confined to that national labour market, and the top incomes don't go up as much.
So it's essentially globalisation that is driving this, then.
It's one of the three factors. So I would think in very simple terms, the three big drivers of top incomes are travel, technology, and taxes. So we see the travel, the international labour markets as driving up particularly CEO salaries. Technology allows people at the top of their game. It sort of acts as a force multiplier, if I can use a military metaphor. So better IT technology allows people who are lawyers or accountants, certainly rock stars, to access a larger customer base or a larger market. And then also tax taxes have been cut at the top of the distribution, and that's helped also boost top incomes.
One of the things that you hear whenever chief executive salaries come up is that we must pay these people who are doubtless talented and very hardworking these enormous sums because we're in this international marketplace and we have to be able to attract people from anywhere in the world. Do we have such a shortage of top talent that is true, or is that just a line that suits everybody?
Well, if you go back to the early 80s, Richard, you can find reports talking about the dearth of management talent in Australia, saying that one of the things that's holding back Australian productivity is a lack of management talent. And we've tackled that in two ways. One way is to improve management training. The other way is to start hiring from the overseas market. And so Bob Joss coming in to head up Westpac, I guess, was one of the early moves. Now, I think most top 50 Australian companies that did a CEO search would do a worldwide CEO search, and we pay a worldwide CEO wage. You certainly see differences in terms of managerial talent. The best managers do seem to raise firm value substantially more than the worst managers, and that then flows through to economic growth, more jobs, better pay in the company. So you don't want to dismiss the idea that managerial talent matters.
On Life Matters Today, if you've been listening for a few years, you'll recognise the voice. It's Andrew Leigh, these days a Labor MP. He's the MP for Fraser, essentially in northern Canberra, but formerly an economist at the ANU and a man who's clearly kept his hand in that department. So how should governments respond to this, Andrew? Should there be a cap on what people can earn?
Well, it's certainly been proposed. So the current Greens Party policy, as I understand it, is a CEO salary more than $1 million ceases to be tax deductible. The challenge with that is that that's sort of a fairly blunt instrument. It comes in and hits all firms, regardless of how large they are. What we've opted to do instead is to try and provide more power in the hands of the shareholders. So we have a two strikes rule now that says that if more than a quarter of shareholders vote down the remuneration report, and that happens 2 years in a row, then that triggers an automatic spill of the board. A pretty strong incentive, you might say, to make sure that remuneration reports aren't opposed by sizable majorities of shareholders. And then there's also reforms around making sure that remuneration consultants don't have ties to the directors, that closely affiliated parties aren't voting. You don't want people voting on their own pay package.
Yeah, although I don't think we've seen any boards spilt yet.
Only in the first year, yeah. So it's got to be two in a row. There's a bunch of companies in this current AGM season who've gotten their first strike and are now, I think, thinking pretty seriously about what the remuneration report will look like for next year.
But the thing with top-level remuneration is it's often not just, you know, a wage or salary. There's other components to it as well. And it occurs to me that all of the top earners, it's probably true for them. There will be inherited wealth. There'll be investments.
Yes, and certainly this is where taxes come in, and so the impact of taxes comes year after year. You get to keep more of the dividend flow, more of the interest earnings, more of the rental, and that gives you more to plough back in the following year. We cut taxes on top earners mostly in the 1980s. In Australia, it was under Hawke, in the US under Reagan, in the UK under Thatcher, and it was a sort of bipartisan notion that these top tax rates in the order of 60 to 70% really were hampering economic activity. I think we got more economic activity out of that, but we also got more inequality.
The other part of the story, I suppose, is the imbalance between the growth of the wage, growth of earnings at the top and middle and lower incomes. So should governments be more concerned about the different rates of growth?
Absolutely. And I think the main thing government should be concerned about is making sure that the benefits of growth are broadly shared across the population. Here you see a very different pattern in Australia and in the United States. In the United States, the wages of somebody who didn't finish high school in inflation-adjusted terms, basically haven't budged for a generation. A high school dropout in America is essentially able to buy as much with their pay packet now as they could in the 1970s. Appalling situation. That's not true of Australia. And in Australia, you've seen steady growth in the incomes of the bottom 10% of households. And so it's not the case that that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. It's just that the rich are getting richer at a faster rate than the rest of us.
Andrew, it's always interesting talking to you. Haven't done it for a while, and it's good to do it again.
I've missed it greatly, Richard. Had a great time in your new job.
Thank you very much. That's Andrew Lee, who's the Labor member for Fraser, which is in essentially northern Canberra in the ACT. But as you heard, there's still a man who keeps his hand in with the economics and finding interesting things to talk about. If you've got something to say about this, you're running out of time. But why don't you give us a ring on 0283 1430, or send us a quick email from abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. Later in the show, we'll have your letters and calls. But next, a cautionary tale for anyone with a tablet computer and an inquisitive child.